Hello, my name is Mike Paske. I'm the editor of the Journal of Southern Religion. I'm in Chicago for the annual meeting of the American Academy of Religion. This evening, I'm going to be speaking with two of my friends and colleagues. First, author of The Color of Christ, Paul Harvey, professor of history at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs, and Kelly Baker, lecturer in religious studies at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. The Journal of Southern Religion has a new issue out, and in it we have several people reviewing The Color of Christ. Tonight we're going to be talking about teaching The Color of Christ. Paul, Kelly, thanks for joining us. Paul,
thank you, Mike.
Can you start, Paul, by just mentioning something about The Color of Christ? Give us a brief synopsis of it before we start talking about the website.
Sure, thanks for asking. The Color of Christ is a book that covers the way that Americans have perceived the form, look, body, shape, skin color, eye color, hair of Jesus for the entirety of American history, basically from the 16th century to the present. And what we try to suggest in the book is the way in which people have imposed a certain kind of look on Jesus has reflected broader social norms, broader social hierarchies, and in particular the way that Jesus over time became a white man in terms of popular perception, and the ways that African Americans and Native Americans responded to the fact that he had become a white man, and the sacralization of whiteness that represented is a primary theme of our book.
I've read it, and I from my perspective, it comes across as a very teachable book. It's something that I expect to use in one of my forthcoming classes in American religion. You've developed a website with Ed Bloom. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The website's address is colorofchrist.com. That's colorofchrist, all one word, .com, just so you can write that down. And the website is intended really for classroom teachers, and it's also intended to be interactive. So, for example, we have various sample syllabi that are up there that people can use. We have lots and lots of suggested PowerPoint templates that you could use for a lecture. Most of the images in the book, we've tracked down some kind of way that you can find them on the internet and put them up and said, here is the picture of Jesus in the Publius Lentulus letter on page 100 or whatever it is, and then it's referenced in the book and you can kind of see what it is, and then you see the URL that you can go to get kind of the full JPG or TIFF image of that. We also have one called Share Your Story, in which we invite people, and you can do this directly on the website, to write about some kind of encounter with an image of Jesus that they've had in their life that has stuck with them. And there's about 10 of them on there right now of all kinds. It can be very informal sorts of essays. So teachers could invite students to write something for a class that could then be posted on that website.
Have you used your book in a class? Or I imagine you use the narrative that's contained in the class.
Yes.
In the book in some classes.
This book actually started, I haven't used it in a class yet, although I will later, but this book started writing it in 2006, more or less, and I taught a class called Jesus in Red, White, and Black that semester, and that was the original title of the book. In fact, it was the title of the book right until they changed it right at the end.
Of course.
And I'm happy with the title as it is. Anyway, so Jesus in Red, White, and Black, I brought Ed in, and it was really a chance to kind of test out the big picture of this book and the general ideas that we had, test out various arguments that we wanted to make. And in that class, I had students do blogs, and they would write blog entries prior to class, and I discovered how much better that made class discussion, because I could see what they were thinking about, and I could come in and say, well, Kelly wrote this and Jim wrote that, and you put those two things together, here's an idea that comes out of that. And you would skip like the first hour of class where you're just trying to figure out what you think, because students could already read that. And so we had a much deeper level of discussion as a result of that. So this kind of had contributed to our idea that a website to accompany the teaching of this book would be really useful for people.
We're here with Kelly Baker, who is currently using the book in a course. Kelly, can you tell us specifically what that course is and how's it going?
Sure. I teach a Global Religions and Race in American Culture course, Survey 100 level course, where previously I'd use Stephen Prothero's American Jesus, paired with Scott Poole's Satan in America, to talk about issues of representation, concerns over bodies, and race was continually a theme. So when Ed and Paul were able to give me an advanced copy of this, I thought, why not try this out as opposed to Prothero, which I like, but I also have some kind of lingering issues with. So this semester we've been testing it out to talk about the way in which religion enforces racial norms in often oppressive but sometimes liberatory ways. And so the text has been really helpful for students to see how this bolsters white supremacy and the resistance to that, and how this continually occurs in a religious context. My students don't want to imagine that religion and race have much to do with each other, and after reading this book, it's kind of unavoidable. I would say it's unavoidable normally, but they're very much engaged with this kind of concept, and so it's a way for me to push them to think about how mutually constitutive these categories are.
And that's exactly what we hope to achieve in terms of resistance to thinking about religion and race together, or just race in general in American history that students are uncomfortable with. But then you say, what's the image of Jesus that you grew up with? And everyone has a particular image, and it's almost always some kind of white European Jesus, usually the Warner Solomon famous painting that's been reproduced endlessly. And then once you start talking about that, you're like, why does he look like that? Because you know he doesn't look like that, really. But of course he looks like that to you, and you can't help but think of him that way. Why is that? And that's a way to get a kind of user-friendly way to get people to think about these deeper questions that they might otherwise try to resist.
Well, and it's an intriguing thing that happens for students when they have to engage these really lovely chapters where they talk about when you poll African-American teenagers that the image of Christ that they turn to is a white Jesus. And for my students in Tennessee, they're really surprised by this because they kind of imagine the identitarian politics where they could sort of understand the racialization of this. But they're so surprised by the dominance of that image, even though they shouldn't be, but they are, and the sort of reactions and the attempts to try to transcend these categories and how they often don't work because the physicality becomes so important. So I really like it for the emphasis on body and material culture, which is something that I try to get them to wrangle with.
Something that strikes me is the idea that with this book, not only are students observing from a kind of cloud level perspective the history of the color of Christ and the racialization of this Christ figure, but also making them complicit in the story. Can you describe any particular examples of students' insight into their personal understanding or how they are situated within the story that you're telling?
I can give you one example that is from a different perspective. Ed and I recently were at Morehouse College, a famously black college, male college in Atlanta, Georgia, and we had a very, very intense discussion of that book for about 2 hours there, and it was something that meant a lot to the people who were there in the Martin Luther King Chapel of Morehouse. But what they were talking about was, and these are students, very post-civil rights students, very attuned to racial identities and politics and the meanings of racial signifiers in American culture, but they all said, but my grandmother had that Warner Solomon picture, and she had the church fan with that, and she had all this other iconography, and I love my grandmother, and I never could figure out why we had that, and she took me to church, and it always kind of bothered me, but I love my grandmother, so I never really said anything, and I couldn't really figure out how to process that information, and I couldn't understand if that was, is that a kind of innocent Jesus that just happens to be white, or is it because my grandmother has unconsciously imbibed something? And they were honestly struggling with that question down to the present day. So it was really a very moving conversation we had with them.
And it's interesting to me to teach this course in Tennessee, where I have primarily white students who don't necessarily want to deal with the implications of privilege and supremacy in these kinds of images. So they have the Warner Solomon images that they assume are totally neutral. And so walking through your book, where you can see very clearly how groups I study, like the Klan, are employing this imagery to cause oppression and the sort of institutional racism, that it's really hard for them to realize that they are complicit in these categories, even when they imagine that they're not. And so we've been working through a lot with them to think about the privileging of the divine and who gets to claim this source, and trying to really work with them to make them understand that when Jesus is racialized in a different way beyond white, that this is an identity politics. It's always identity politics, and they don't want to do this with whiteness. So it's been kind of challenging to get them to talk through what their attachments are to those kind of images and how attached they are to also the kind of disembodied vision of the divine when we're continually seeing these images that you have, right? And I pull up my own images in this too, and trying to get them to think through always, like, what are you imbibing? And what are you, so the grandmothers, what are they consuming, right? And to get my students to think really carefully, like, what are you consuming too? And some of them are deeply uncomfortable about this, and others, like, get it and find it really radically wonderful. So it's hard to kind of figure out where they're at, but they're not entirely sure sometimes what to do with the arguments that you have because the issues are so fraught.
This is a book about religion, but it's also, obviously, a book about race. Teaching with this book, do you think that because it is a chronological survey of American religious history through the prism of race, do you think it's ordinarily going to be the case that it becomes a course about race, even if it's not a course about race?
I think most American history courses become a course about race, even when they're not a course about race. And so I don't think that's going to change the picture. I really do hope it gives students a way beyond academic language and jargon and all that, a way to say, let me back up. One of the student responses I expect to get, because I always get this on our various things that we've written on blogs and CNN and, you know, the other things that were popular online magazines that we've written for, is, well, people just create images of the divine that look like them. Everyone does that. That's like human nature. So what's the big deal? But in fact, what we show in the book is, no, they don't do that, because in fact, some people have the power to control imagery and the spread of imagery, and some people do not. Slaves cannot control what the imagery of Jesus comes to look like at the very moment, antebellum era, pre-Civil War, that's the era in which Jesus becomes a white man who is widely distributed. And slaves can't do anything about that, but they have to respond to it in some way. So I think that's a different way to think about race that maybe hits some students who might not want to think about it otherwise.
I think it's a good conversation starter for them to talk about things like social capital and political power and the sort of power of representations and how these groups work. So my students, when they read the chapter on Martin Luther King, where he's like punting on this question of race, I've never seen students so disenchanted in my lifetime, where they're like, all these other people understand what's at stake at this, you know, like that Malcolm X understands this in interesting ways, and all these other black national movements get this, and then King does this thing that my students find totally unsatisfying, and also you show historical actors find unsatisfying, so they're really surprised that this revolutionary civil rights leader is trying to sort of avoid this question, and so then we really get into the idea about, so what's at stake at this, and why would he do this? And I think it's instructive to them because they love to sort of sanctify him in interesting ways and to realize that race relations are really complicated, and if we're not paying attention to power, then we're missing something really important.
Just very briefly about that, what Kelly is referring to is a letter written to Martin Luther King in which someone says, basically, what does Jesus look like? And Martin Luther King says, well, of course, it's the spirit of Jesus that we should be talking about, not what he looks like. So he is no less significant because he was white. And that's just King imbibing the unconscious assumption, trying to disavow the race of Jesus as having any significance, but nonetheless affirming the race of Jesus. And that's the thing that I think would really disenchant or make your students uncomfortable. But it's not because King was trying to imbibe them with any kind of ideology. It was purely unconscious on his part. And it was just something I found by accident in researching in the Martin Luther King papers, but very, very much indicative of the power, the unconscious power of imagery.
So obviously, the book has very clear theses, and it has very important conclusions that it makes, but it seems whenever we talk about the students, there's lots that's still unsettled for readers, lots that's still left ambiguous, which leads to a kind of takeaway that is ongoing for students or for any reader for that matter. And it seems like the website, to return to the website, is a way to collectively continue that conversation beyond the book.
Absolutely. One of the things that we've found already in going to various places is people saying, what about my Jesus? For example, Asian American scholars saying, you don't talk about Asian Americans at all. Not quite true. There's some little bit of a discussion, but largely that's not a group that we attempted to talk about. And so, and it's true, and we actually addressed that in the introduction, saying we're not going to address every single group. We're going to kind of address the dominant power imagery that has been passed down. Now, for those of you who come from different traditions, different racial, ethnic groups, whatever, there's plenty more to be said about your particular experience that you don't address. So with this Asian American scholar, he's going to head up a forum that we hope to publish both on my blog, usreligion.blogspot.com, Religion and American History, as well as colorofchrist.com, in which we have a kind of forum about how do Asian Americans deal with this, because this is such a black, white, partially Indian kind of thing, and then Asian Americans come later, late 19th century, into the story, and how do they, many of them are Christians, how do they think about this story? Same thing with Latino Christians, who we largely don't talk that much about in the book. So we hope to have other kinds of forums, and as I said, we hope that people will write in their stories on the Share Their Story link at colorofchrist.com, or if they want to record an interview or record them talking about something, we have YouTube-style interviews posted with people addressing these kinds of things already up on the website, where you see the link that says video interviews, and we invite people to do that and send them to us.
What are some of the syllabi that are up, which is one part of this, and then also any of the particular stories that are compelling to you or that are speaking to the concerns that you're raising?
There's about six or seven different syllabi that are up there that have various ways of, from history, religious studies, sociology, of approaching race, religion, and American history. So I just invite people to click where it says syllabi and just scan them and to just start harvesting, plagiarizing ideas for whatever they want to do.
People can appropriate mine all they want to, right? Just use it willy-nilly
in
how
will.
They want to, yes.
And there are all sorts of different stories under the Share Their Story link to the website. And one of them is of a child who was kind of terrified by a Jesus who was kind of blinking at him. And so it's kind of hard to describe. I just invite people to read that. It's a very, very funny but ultimately kind of moving story about being terrified by Jesus.
Well, I can't thank enough Paul Harvey, Kelly Baker, for speaking this evening about The Color of Christ, both the book and the website, and the tools that are available to us to teach with this wonderful book. Also, Ed Bloom, who's not here, thank you. Also, I'd like to thank Arthur Remillard, who is our sound engineer tonight, and who really does run this podcast program ordinarily, and I really can't thank him enough for all that he does for the Journal of Southern Religion. So on behalf of myself and Luke Harlow at the University of Tennessee, thank you very much for listening to Paul and to Kelly. One last word, Paul?
Last word is Art Remillard rules the world, so
totally
pay obeisance to him.
Totally.
And we're not going to edit that out. Good evening, everyone.